We want to alert you that some of the content you're about to hear in these podcasts could be upsetting and distressing. So please be aware, this may not be the right moment to listen. In this edition of Child Protection Committee Scotland's series of podcasts, we're talking about the vexed issue of online abuse. And indeed, there can be no doubt that cybercrime against children is a real and present danger. Research published in 2024 by the Childlike Global Child Safety Institute at the University of Edinburgh found that more than 300 million children a year are victims of online sexual exploitation and abuse. And here in Scotland, in 2023 alone, Police Scotland data showed that there were over 670 incidences of communicating indecently with a child reported. So in today's podcast, we wanted to find out from our two special guests if we're in danger of being swamped by an unstoppable tidal wave of cybercrime against children, or if we still have the scope to build flood barriers. To get us started, I asked our two contributors to introduce themselves.
Hi, my name is Jess McBeth. I'm an online safety consultant. I work with a charity called SWGFL, and we are part of the UK Safer Internet Centre.
Thank you very much, Jess. Now, who are you?
Hi, I'm Kirsty Paisley. I'm currently a detective sergeant within the Online Child Sexual Abuse and Exploitation Team, also known as the OXE Team, because police like to shorten things.
Of course, we like an acronym.
Yes. I'm based at Fettes Police Station in Edinburgh. Our team is made up of two sergeants and 14 detective constables, and we cover the east of Scotland. And on a daily basis, we target perpetrators of online child sexual abuse and exploitation.
And you've had a pretty long shift. You came in here, we had to give you some help with some coffee because you've just done 18 hours. You did say it's been really busy, which is depressing but also quite reassuring, Kirsty.
Yes.
Is that an indicator of how bad things are at the moment? Are things particularly busy?
We are busy, yes. Referrals to Police Scotland for online child sexual abuse and exploitation are increasing. My team is one of three that covers Scotland.
Just three teams covering the whole of
Scotland? Three teams that cover Scotland, yes. And on a daily basis, we target perpetrators of online child sexual abuse and exploitation. So we are busy.
I'll bet. Let's look at the stats. And I know that they can be misleading and we can cherry pick stats. But Jess, if we start with you, what is your understanding about the scale of online abuse? Because the figures look really depressing and a bit scary. I think it's, 3 million children globally a year. But what about here in Scotland?
Yeah, I was having a look at the Childlike stats, actually, and they were talking about 150,000 Scottish children abused online annually, which is enormous. Clearly, police will come in here as well. We know that not every incident is reported. They're not caught. So it's very, very difficult to actually really estimate the prevalence. But from my perspective, it's absolutely, it's out there, it's in our communities, it's happening to children that we know, it's happening to children in a classroom, there'll be children that it's happening to. And yet it's not understood enough, it's not talked about enough.
Well, we're hoping to change that today, but do you think we're just seeing the tip of the iceberg with the official stats?
Oh, absolutely. I mean, it would be...
Worse now, do you think, than maybe even 10 years ago?
Well, So within the UK Safer Internet Centre, it's three partner organisations, and one of those is the Internet Watch Foundation. And that's a charity that you can report child sexual abuse material to if you find it online. But they also proactively search for it. They started the proactive searching for it online back in 2014. And they reported recently that since 2014, they've seen an 830% increase in the imagery that they find.
Say that again.
830% increase.
330.
Yeah, so it's 830% increase in the imagery that they found online since they began doing it in 2014. So it's a phenomenal and it's a growing issue.
And is that purely because they're going out looking for it now? That's why the stats...
Well, they started looking for it in 2014.
So that's 10 plus years of
looking,
doing
and it increases. Every year, basically, they report the same thing. They say this year's the worst year for it.
Are you surprised by that, Kirsty?
No, not really. I think society lives their life online now. So the internet has evolved since 2014. people are using the internet more and more each day. Your mobile phone now is a walking computing device. You do everything online, online banking, social media sites, everything's done online. And that's not only adults, that's children as well now. You can see children at a younger age getting mobile phones, being on social media sites like Facebook, Snapchat. So I think it's just a reality now that we live in an online world, and that's increasingly growing. And as a result of that, perpetrators are going to use that to their advantage.
We're never going to get on top of it because the tech is changing so quickly, and it's so available to all ages at all stages now, it seems. It's ubiquitous.
Yes, it is difficult. The internet's evolving, perpetrators are evolving in how they use the internet, using things like end-to-end encryption sites to try and avoid detection. So, you know, there is difficulties in trying to catch these people, but we are catching them.
When we're talking about terms like abuse, online abuse, what kinds of things are you seeing, Jess? Can you explain?
I work right across all kinds of online harms. So obviously sexual harms, but all kinds as well. So violent, financial harms, disinformation, mental health impact, bullying, all kinds of stuff.
It's a huge range, isn't it?
It is a huge range. I suppose I would come back a wee bit to what Kirsty was saying, which is about digital life is life.
And so, and it's here and it's not going anywhere.
No, absolutely. It's completely embedded. And we've known this for a long time, particularly for children and young people, for those that do have access online. It is absolutely part and parcel of everyday life. So whatever you see happening in somebody's offline life, there'll be an element of that that happens online. So essentially, it will amplify and potentially distort what's happening. So where people find ways to abuse one another. It's terribly depressing, aren't we?
But yes.
There's lots of wonderful things about technology. You know, it is amazing and it provides opportunities, and we want our kids to have all the amazingness that they can get from living a good life online.
For sure, but...
But, yes, it is an issue. And so I suppose technology is used in two ways, really. One is literally just an extension to offline harm. So where a child might be abused and now technology is involved in that. We might see other things happening where the technology has enabled something new to happen.
For instance?
So deepfakes, for example, would be where you've got technology that's able to create new content, you know, in a way that it isn't possible without technology. It wasn't something that happened before particularly. So it kind of does both. Those kind of things, I would say.
What about you? When you think of the word, Kirsty, online abuse, what sort of thing and what sort of images are you thinking about?
So probably the offences that we deal with on a daily basis are possession of indecent images of children, distribution of indecent images of children, sometimes for financial gain, indecent communications where perpetrators speak with other like-minded individuals about sexually abusing children, grooming of children online for sexual gratification, and in some cases extortion or coercion, asking children to send indecent images of themselves. So there's a lot of offences that we deal with on a daily basis.
It just seems like, just talking to you too, there is so much so much content out there now. It's overwhelming. So you must have strategies to deal with that and to identify what the big risks are and where the barriers are to being able to do much about it. But can we even describe, Jess, start off by looking at the techniques, this is pretty grim stuff, online abusers will use to attract, in particular, children, vulnerable children?
Yeah, I mean, it's a really difficult one. I don't necessarily want to broadcast all the different techniques
that people
use. I would. There's actually quite a nice little training course, if people are interested, called Dragon Shield. It was created by Swansea University, and that looks at the linguistic communication techniques of grooming, which is very interesting. So I'd recommend anybody that wants to understand more about that, go and do that training. If you step back for a minute, we know that a lot of perpetrators will use a scattergun approach, right? So they're putting out contacts, for example. It's very easy using technology, isn't it, to send a message to lots and lots of people, to connect with lots of people, potentially children. And what they're looking for is that hook back, right? That a child that is looking for something online and
right,
will respond.
So this is what intrigues me. How do they identify that a child is potentially there to be exploited? How do they know who to target. As you say, it's scattergun, it's just luck. But there must be something they're picking up on from a particular response from a child that's making them think, right, going with this.
So I suppose if you look at it from the other way around, what we might be doing online, and I would say all of us, not just children, when you use technology, you're meeting a need, right? Whatever you do, but when you watch something, share something, like something, send a message, post something, there's some reason that you've done that, right? And we quite often do that without really being self-aware about what that need is that we're trying to meet. Now, children will do this as well, of course, as anybody else. But if we think about those needs, we might be looking for friendship. We might be looking for validation. We might be looking to be somebody different online, to be something new and exciting. We might be looking to learn about something that we feel maybe uncomfortable talking to, you know, somebody face to face about. So those are the kinds of things where a child might put something out. So they might be posting a lot, for example, where they're looking for comments on images, right? And the underlying message there is, please validate me. So it's those kinds of things. But the scattergun approach is very simple to do. You will reach lots of people, and then some of them will respond.
And it's all at the click of a button. It's all so simple, isn't it? It's straightforward. Kirsty, you want to add to that?
Yeah, I mean, they don't need to leave their house in order to make contact with potentially multiple children in one go.
We're talking in these terms, and we're talking about children, vulnerable, exploitation. But let's start with that word that you're using a lot because you're a cop. The perpetrator.
Yes.
The person that's committing the crime and targeting people online. And it is just it's people, it's not just children, it's anyone online can be vulnerable to this. But when I say the word perpetrator, how do you define what a perpetrator is?
Someone who's committing offences online of child sexual abuse.
So to you, it's a more narrowly defined thing. It's usually sexual abuse you're going after. So, okay, what about you, Jess?
So in terms of defining a perpetrator, yeah, I mean, I would see that as a kind of a term within the sort of criminal justice space as somebody that's broken the law. Again, I tend to step back a little bit and look at things. Other stats that I've picked up, for example, 10% of children have seen pornography by the age of 9. The average age to see porn is at 13. And by 18, 79% of young people will have seen violent pornography, right? So I think we probably need to look a little bit at the actual context that we're in here as well, quite a sexualized media context. We've also got a growing understanding that we tend to think of the kind of the boyfriend model when we think of grooming. You know, it's older man, it's middle-aged man pretending to be, you know, a young man and grooming somebody by pretending to be their boyfriend and, you know, getting to know them over a period of time and all this kind of stuff.
You're about to tell us that's not...
That does happen.
It can
that absolutely
happen.
Happens. But there's lots of different ways that people groom and abuse online. And, of course, lots of teenagers as well can be perpetrating harmful sexual conduct and behaviour with other young people. There's a lot more context here, I suppose, about society as well and about what our understanding is of what a healthy relationship is, etc., etc.
It's really interesting because I think we've got an image in our mind of what a perpetrator kind of looks like and we think we can identify them. But that's quite misleading, isn't it, Kirsty?
It is, yeah. I think even myself, before I joined this department, I had an idea in my head of what a perpetrator of these types of offences looked like. And that definitely isn't the case. It's all ages, all different types of employment. It's not just a one size fits all.
Are you surprised sometimes when you look at someone that you're about to target or you've brought in for questioning and you think, wow, to the outside world, you are so plausible. You just would never guess. Is that a common feeling when you guys go after somebody?
Yeah, that has happened before, yeah. Yeah, sometimes the person that you have in front of you is not what you would expect or what you would have in your head. Like I say, it's people with good jobs, a family, children, a wife, husband. Yeah, it can be anybody.
Isn't that the problem then, Jess? That, you know, potentially we must be vigilant, but you don't want to freak everyone out and go, gosh, everything's potentially dangerous and possibly a perpetrator trying to lure my child online. But at the same time, you can't just get this wee image into your head that it's just a particular type. Maybe it's a guy of a certain age and, you know, doesn't go out very much. And also, we don't tend automatically to think about women doing this, but they must do.
Yeah, although I believe the prevalence is lower. I heard somebody talking about this quite a while ago, about some of the messaging that we give to children and young people, which I thought was really helpful. And the way that they framed it, and I really wish I could remember their name so I could actually reference them. The way they framed it was that we talk a lot about stranger danger, right? When actually what we need to talk about is strange behaviour. Right.
Okay. So what sort of things?
So the idea being that with stranger danger, it's very much, you know, the man in the trench coat type thing, and, you know, don't get into a car with a stranger and that kind of stuff, and beware of strangers online. But actually the realistic situation for children and for adults online is that we are in a multi-user environment. So we might be gaming online, chatting with friends and friends of friends. Is that a friend? And then when that person wants to go and have a conversation with us in a one-to-one scenario, perhaps on an end-to-end encrypted app.
And that will happen a lot.
Yeah, and that's the kind of red flag that children often aren't aware of, is simple things like that. So what we need to do with children is really ensure that they are alive to something's not quite right here. Something seems a bit off. That could be somebody that we've met online, we don't know them, and naturally we should be a bit more aware. But it could be somebody in the family as well. I think when we talk about online, we tend to think that it's all just about strangers contacting children. But of course, as I say, people will use technology now as every part of life, and people will abuse children, you know, in the family, and they'll be using technology as part of that as well. So it's just that being aware, you know, helping children to just have a little bit of that spidey sense.
So quite often, or maybe I'm making a generalization here, that maybe children don't realize the dangers that they're getting into, but sometimes they will. But who's teaching them that? And whose responsibility is that? I don't know. Kirsty, do you want to say something about that as somebody that picks up the pieces after you've...
I think it's everyone's responsibility. I think from parents, teachers, police, I think we all have a responsibility to ensure that we are trying to keep our children safe online as much as we can. We can't put all the onus on the child itself. I think we all need to help children be aware, and maybe, like you were saying, have that spidey sense to, you know, if they think something's not quite right here, that they can then tell someone about that as well, or report it, or speak to someone about it.
That sounds like a great idea, but then it means that everyone else is waiting for everybody else to fill that gap in their knowledge and say, oh, you know, your parents should be dealing with that. No, the school should be dealing with that. Who ultimately should be responsible for having a pretty awkward, maybe, conversation with a child that's, you know, they care for?
So it's fascinating, isn't it? If we think about abuse of children, we know that it's getting worse online. So what we're doing isn't quite working. And I think there's probably quite a lot of education going on with children in schools on all aspects of online safety, and particularly sexual abuse online. I'm aware that I used to volunteer myself for the NSPCC, and I know that they still go into schools, primary schools, and do sort of preventive messaging and supportive work with children on a child protective basis. But we can't really educate our way out of this. It's obviously much, much broader. So I think education is absolutely a part. I would say we've probably learned over the years about what works and what doesn't work so well within education. So the scary messages don't tend to work.
So that is not something that's going to put somebody off if you say, oh, this might happen. Are they just discounting it?
It will put some off.
But generally, it's not effective.
So we used to do, you know, scary videos. Mm-hmm. You know, here's the video of this poor girl, and she's been groomed and abused and murdered, and what should she have done? And what would you do if, you know, if, all that kind of stuff. So lots of eye rolling going on. The child watching that video that's actually being abused already is stuck, triggering. And really, it doesn't work, because most kids go, oh, for goodness sake, that's never going to happen to me.
That'll never happen to me.
Is it happening because they're viewing it in a peer group? And of course, that's peer group behaviour, isn't it? That you roll your eyes if it's anything contentious. You just don't want it to look like you're uncool. And that's if, for example, they're seeing that maybe at home with a parent with them, do you think maybe the message would hit home? I'm just wondering about the context for viewing these scary videos. Not that I'm saying, or scary films, I'm not saying they don't work because of that.
No doubt there'll be some children that go, oh goodness, right, okay, you know, I'm going to watch myself here.
You're not convinced.
But are those, you know, are those the vulnerable children, the ones that might be more at risk, say? So I think we've kind of moved on from that a little bit, and it's more understanding about individual context. There's lots of research now that shows that we take our offline vulnerabilities online. And so really understanding when we're working from an educational perspective, when we're working with children, what's going on with that child? What might make that child more vulnerable? What strengths do they have online? How capable are they of actually understanding risk? Would they come to an adult if something was really worrying them, or would they panic, right? Are they desperate for friendship? Are they being bullied? All these kind of things will help you as a professional or as a parent to really understand how much at risk is my child and what supports do I need to give them.
But that relies on a parent being really vigilant and attentive to that child and thinking, well, I never thought of it in the round like that. You know, let's look at what your vulnerabilities are and what your strengths are and just see how that can feed into how you use the internet and your experience in the internet.
I think they do, because I think parents do that anyway.
Do you think they just, it happens subliminally?
The example I always give to parents is, I want you to imagine you've got twins, right? They look the same, they sound the same, they're not the same. Right. And you will parent each child differently depending on that whole context. You know, can they go and stay overnight at a friend's house? You're going to think to yourself, how would they cope with that? It will differ. So it's just about thinking about online with that same mindset as well.
What do you make of that? What do you think we should be doing? Because it's not just about educating with scary films or videos. You guys and the police know what it's like when you see some of the content and some of the damage that's been done. What works? What doesn't work?
I think it is difficult because, like you were saying, you don't want to scare children half to death so that they think that they can't go online. But at the same time, you want them to have an awareness of what can happen. And like you said, the police are the ones that pick up the pieces afterwards. I don't know what the right answer is, if I'm honest.
Do we have any idea how we could maybe aim at deterring predators from doing this, or, you know, perpetrators from going online and trying to do this sort of thing? What have we got in our armoury to make them think twice about doing this kind of thing? Is there anything that stops them?
In terms of stopping them going online and committing it in the first place, I don't know why these people do this in the first place. So it's hard to say how you would stop them from doing that.
But once they have, you know, entered the process of the criminal justice system,
yes,
you then can do, you know, stop bail. But what else? Can you refuse to let them near electronic devices and things?
So after they've been charged, we can put conditions in place where they're have limited access to devices. They're not allowed devices that are capable of going on the internet. They're not allowed to use certain software and things like that. Though that's after the fact. That's after they've been charged with an offence.
I'm aware of a few sort of preventive type approaches, and we probably need to put a lot more effort into this kind of stuff. So one of them, which I believe is Stop It Now and Lucy Faithful Foundation. So they worked with, I believe it was Pornhub, to put up warning messages depending on the search that you made. So, for example, a common search on Pornhub might be for teen porn, right? You know, you start to wonder about the pathways, right? Mm. So depending on the search term, and if it looks like it's looking for child sexual abuse imagery, it will come up with a kind of warning sign. You need to be careful what you're searching for here. Mm. And here's how you can go and get some help.
So it's not about, here's the criminal justice system coming for you. It's about, this is for your welfare.
By the way, I mean, we have a huge, a real potential issue that is growing and on the horizon, which is AI-generated child sexual abuse imagery.
Right. Now that cannot, you can't put that back in the box. That's out there now. That's happening.
Yes. So it is possible using some of the generative AI products to create child sexual abuse imagery, not the major ones, right? There are safeguards in place. So you can't just go to ChatGPT. There are ways to do it to create child sexual abuse imagery. And this is a whole series of issues, starting with the idea that people might think, well, that's not illegal. So this is fine. I can indulge my sort of
vicariously.
Yes, yeah. I can do this. It's not illegal. Well, first of all, that's not true. It is legal. And they might say, right, no child is getting hurt. Now, this is problematic. And I remember somebody from the IDOF talking to me about this. This is problematic, first of all, because there was a little bit of research that shows this kind of imagery can be a pathway towards, you know, actual abuse of children. Secondly, it can normalise this kind of content. So, you know, the more that is created, the more people look at it, the more it feels like that's
you're inured to normal. It's not shocking anymore. So you go for maybe a more extreme.
Well, it just normalises the idea that you might see sexual content of children. There is also the creation of weird and unusual content, because of course you're creating something that is
doesn't exist
in your mind. Yeah. And then we get into, say, the IWF, imagery gets reported to them, a picture or a video, which looks completely real. And so now they're thinking, is that a child that needs safeguarded? We're getting a police involved, we're looking for a child. That child does not exist. This is a real issue and something that we need to address societally for people to go, no, that is not something that I'm going to do.
I'm just guessing. There aren't enough resources, anywhere near the resources that are needed to start to tackle this stuff that's coming up or is on the horizon already. It's not coming up, it's there.
Yeah, and I mean, there have been issues, nudification apps, for example, on the app stores.
I never even knew there was such a thing, my goodness.
So a nudification app is the idea that you can take a picture of somebody, a real photo of somebody, and then put that face onto... basically take the clothes off, make it look as if they haven't got any clothes on. And those were available on the app stores because for some reason the app stores didn't think that was a problem. And they only work on girls' bodies because reflecting what's happening in society. So, you know, lots of layered issues here. And some of which is about technology companies and regulation and all that kind of stuff. But a lot of it, I do always come back to, we need to start doing the right things.
But again, you've just told me stuff that I didn't know. And we're not having these conversations, are we? People think they've got an idea what online abuse is, Kirsty. And, you know, you were going to interject as well when we were just talking about the AI stuff, the computer generated stuff that can lead to other things and look incredibly real. What are you seeing in the police?
Yes, so we are seeing AI-generated images of children which look real. So when you're looking at that image, you can't tell, is that a real child or is it an AI-generated image? So like you say, there's then concerns about, is this a real child and is this a child that we need to find and we need to safeguard?
How often does that happen?
It's starting to happen a bit more often now, just with technology developing and AI technology developing. Also, what you said about perpetrators committing online offences, I totally agree with what you say in that I think they think that because they are not physically harming the child that
it's
they're not doing
crime.
Anything wrong, which obviously is not the case whatsoever.
One final point, I suppose, whilst we're on the scaremongering.
We'll get over that in a minute.
Yeah. So we have the kind of fully created sort of deepfake imagery where it's a completely fabricated image, but we also have the problem of taking a picture of a child that's in the neighbourhood, for example, taking a picture of a child that's been shared online and then putting that picture, creating a deepfake video, for example, with that child looking like they're in sexual positions. So it is... Yeah, it does really start to ask questions, difficult ones for us actually, about sharing pictures of children online at all. And nobody wants to, I don't want to go there, and I'm not going to say that you mustn't do that, but it is being aware and alive to some of the risks that are out there.
Gosh, learning so much from this conversation. I'm just thinking about the sort of gateway for kids to go and young people to go online. You know, innocuous platforms, we think, you know, Facebook, WhatsApp. WhatsApp's encrypted, so that's maybe slightly different. Instagram, TikTok, things like that. Are we wrong to let them enjoy so much play in that area? Or is it a case of, no, we need to allow them to have some sort of online existence and life, but we just, as you say, have to be ultra cautious about where that's taking them because perpetrators, predators are lurking.
So we did see an increase from the pandemic, and it's really subsequent to that, of younger and younger children, you know, being abused online. So the kind of imagery that was coming to the surface was of younger and younger children and more on the abusive end of the scale as well since the pandemic and onwards. And I think that does reflect the idea that younger children were in spaces where they could engage with other people. So it is problematic. The access to technology is fascinating, and you know, if you look at something like YouTube, I can't remember what the stat is, but it's something like 90%, I can't remember, of 3- and 4-year-olds are watching YouTube.
On YouTube?
Yes. A large proportion of I shouldn't quote the stat, I don't have them in front of me, but it's something like a quarter or a third of 3- and 4-year-olds are on live streaming platforms. So something's not going, you know, quite how we want it to here. And it is about engaging parents.
Want to say to kids, you can't have any online fun and activity, because that's a skill set as well that you're removing from them to communicate, interact.
Totally. I mean, there's so many, you know, families are, you know, from think of the pandemic, right? They were all using...
What would you have done if you couldn't
FaceTime
go online?
And all of this to engage. So it's wonderful. There are lots of resources out there for parents, I think.
Tell us about them, because there'll be a lot of people that are professionals that are also parents that maybe don't know this stuff.
What I was going to say, I suppose, was, see, if we think traditionally about how we might engage parents from an education standpoint, for example, we might run a parents' online safety night, you know, invite the parents in. And what you happen is you get five, you know, we're hoping for 50 parents and you get 5, and they weren't the 5 that you really wanted. And they're all coming when their kids are about 10 anyway. If we look at children's use of technology and parents' use of technology, there are some concerns about very, very young children. And it's not just about the kind of grooming and abuse side. But if we look at babies, there are some concerns about eye contact. So babies look for eye contact with an adult, and then they look for that reciprocal smile that's going on, and the neurons are firing and the connections are being made and the empathy and all this kind of stuff's developing. Now, when you use a phone, what happens is you look at the phone, you have a blank face. There's no expression on your face, right, because you're on the phone. And we get into flow when we're on our devices. Flow is when we are engaged and absorbed. We've all been there, right? So there are concerns about what's happening with babies if parents are using devices. There is research that shows that young children, the kind of 2, 3, 4-year-olds, sometimes are not managing to get the attention of mum or dad. They're trying, you know, they're tugging at the
We're talking about emotional neglect then, aren't we? We're getting into that area.
The reason they're not getting attention is just because the parents are absorbed in the phone.
Yeah,
not
and we all do it. We've all done it.
So you've got that, along with oversharing by parents, anecdotes, photographs, the first day at school picture, the happy birthday. So there's multiple issues going on to do with parenting, and it's not just about children talking to a stranger online, it's the whole thing. I also, on my final little rant,
go for it.
While I'm on a roll, is that quality children's programming, right? I do wonder about what young children are accessing in terms of good quality programming that are created, that are developmentally age, you know, and stage appropriate, you know, and what actually they're getting within the home in terms of is it TikTok and it's Netflix wall to wall?
That's a really interesting point, yeah. Isn't it? Because
Things like News Round, you know, like children's news, lots of issues there. So these things are a lot bigger, I think, about media and digital and technology than just the kind of access to chatting online. In terms of resources, which is what you asked me, sorry, resources. Resources. I always point parents to Internet Matters, which is a really great website with mountains and mountains and mountains of content on that, including content for if you've got a young person who's vulnerable or
Internet matters.
I would point to. The Scottish Government has got its Parent Club website. It's got some online safety content on there as well. And then the final bit, I suppose, is you'll find some of this on Internet Matters. There are other websites as well, but it's just to say parental controls. Obviously, there is a lot of parental control stuff available on different apps and games, and you know, it's a bit complex and confusing.
That's
but there
the problem,
is
isn't it? Because
there.
I know I've got a great niece who's about 11, and her parents are trying to control what she sees. And I was thinking, do they even understand? You know, that they've probably got more settings or more things they could be doing. Do you think that's quite common, that people are trying the best to keep up, but they really don't know, and maybe they don't want to know at one level? I don't know. It's a horrible thought that your child might be accessing things that you don't have control over, but you're not savvy enough, tech savvy enough, or you don't think you are, to do much about it.
So I think the confidence thing affects, and I'm a parent as well, I think the confidence thing affects parents and it affects professionals too. And I think that's a huge issue for all of us that work with children and young people, or vulnerable adults as well, is about feeling actually confident to have those conversations. You don't need to know it all. Just start having the conversations.
Kirsty, you've been listening to all that, and I'm thinking about the parental point of view. How do parents react when they find out that their children have been seeing, hearing, participating in things that they just couldn't have thought of?
Most of the time they're shocked, because they obviously aren't aware that their child has potentially been put in that position where they've seen something they shouldn't, or they've been engaging in something that's not being quite right.
Are they angry? And who are they angry at?
Most of the time, they're more concerned for their child, I would say. I've been into hundreds of houses and spoke to hundreds of parents in my time within child protection. In my experience, I think parents generally are trying to do their best. And like you say, they don't have the knowledge or the expertise to know what's the latest thing going on in technology. What can I do to help keep my child on safe online?
So I guess, you know, they're just hoping, aren't they, that they don't bump into any of this stuff, and they think they've probably done enough to talk to them about it and maybe tweak a few settings. And I'm not being judgmental here, but I'm saying that would probably be the norm, wouldn't it? Because not many people are going to be really pursuing the tech stuff and going, whoa, I need to look this up online. I don't know. Maybe more will now after hearing this. I hope they do.
And it's difficult as well, because I think parents are stuck in this position where they want to trust their child. They want to give them some sort of independence, especially when they're getting to kind of teenage years. And they don't want their child to be, you know, the only child in their year at school that doesn't have Snapchat, or that doesn't have the latest mobile phone with all the fancy bits and pieces to it.
Absolutely. So, it's very hard to make that judgment call, isn't it? Because everybody else is normalising. What about the message that you give to parents then when you, you know, you're talking to parents after something's happened and you're discussing how to make things better? What advice are the police giving to parents?
If they don't know how to keep their child unsafe, probably, you know, looking at websites like you were speaking about, Child Exploitation and Online Protection, is Online Safety Centre, where parents can go for advice or to get guidance on how to keep their child safe online.
What is this resource? And is this a website then that's a sort of online thing
online
where they can go for more?
Online Safety Centre, and it's where children and adults can get advice or guidance with regards to reporting potential abuse.
Do you think many parents even know about the existence of that?
Probably
that's
not.
That's a bit sad, isn't it? Because that sounds like a pretty interesting resource, Jess.
Yeah, I think people do struggle a little bit in finding resources. There probably is more that we can do to try and direct and make sure that people are aware of where to go. There was something that I wanted to bring up, which is slightly different, and I don't know.
Go for it.
So over the last year, I've had a few people that I know approach me, as well as parents approach me, where they've discovered that their child has been groomed or sexually exploited online, and sextortion as well. But there was one in particular that kind of jumped out at me, which I think is something for us as professionals to think about. And what happened in this example was this woman, her daughter had developed an eating disorder and had sort of behavioural change, clearly wasn't happy. This was happening over a series of months. And she went through kind of services, including NHS, to kind of address what was going on, all the rest of it. This went on for quite a long time. And eventually, and not much seemed to be changing, really. And then eventually, her daughter's friends came to her as a parent and said, I think you need to know that your daughter's got this very weird boyfriend online. And so what was actually happening was she was being controlled by this boyfriend that she'd made online. She was about 12 at the time. And so that was what was happening. She was being abused online. But the reason I bring this up is because online abuse didn't feature in any of the responses from the services that she went to. So with health, for example, she wasn't asked what's happening online. And part of the reason for that is because online and digital is seen as some sort of separate thing, whereas it needs to be completely integrated into processes.
Who's going to do that? Who's going to make that happen?
So this is part of this, you know, this is what I'm saying to people is go and have a look at your actual processes that you follow, your procedures, your policies, your strategies, your vision. Have you got technology built into that? Because once it starts to get built in, if the checklists that you follow and the processes actually ask children about their online lives, you will start to learn and hear more, and you'll start to put the pieces together. It feels like sometimes it's the missing piece.
But if it's not on the checklist, then you're not going to go looking for it. I find that quite extraordinary. But then again, that's the sort of silos that we are in.
And
you
it's
know.
Not you know it's nobody's fault. It's just because it's
the
evolved
way it is.
So quickly. Things have changed so much, as you say, over the last 10 years or so even. So we're at the point now, though, where we need to start going, what do we understand about children's lives online, right? What are they actually doing? What do we know about the children that we serve? What are they doing online? Are they enjoying life? What's difficult? And start to build back from that in terms of our policies.
What about regulation? Do you think the government should be more involved, less involved? Do you think the tech companies should take more responsibility for this?
So I can't comment too much on that. There is regulation happening. We've got the Online Safety Act. We've got other pieces of regulation as well. It's back to that jigsaw puzzle. So it's absolutely in there. And some of the harms that we've described will hopefully lessen. So things like access to pornography, it should become a lot more difficult for children to stumble across pornography online, for example.
Should become.
Yes. What I would say is I'd be really, really wary of, these are not really technology problems. Right? They're the use of technology to abuse and harm. The tech isn't really the problem itself. And so technology isn't a solution either. Right? So you can put parental controls in place. You can have extra checks and things happening on social media platforms, for example. But that will not protect all children. So plenty of teenagers will find ways to find porn online, for example, right? You know, plenty of teenagers will find ways to do all kinds of things. So that's why you need everything else in place, which is the education and the sport.
It's a huge societal thing then, isn't
yeah,
it?
Yeah,
which
yeah.
means that a lot of people are let off the hook because they're waiting for somebody else to jump first and do something first, aren't they?
Well, I think the problem is more that people think, I don't need to do anything then. Fine. As a parent, whew, thank goodness, the Online Safety Act's coming in and I don't have to worry about that anymore. And my message would be far from it. You know, we are early steps in that.
Online Safety Act, what's your view on that? Do you think it's going to make a big difference, or do you think people are a little bit complacent, maybe a little bit naive about what the impact of that will be? It's not going to be a safeguard that's complete.
No, I don't think it's going to be a safeguard. And like you say, we still need to do other things. I think it's moving in the right direction, regulating social media firms and file sharing sites and making sure that they have child protection policies in place to assist keeping children safe online. We're moving in the right direction.
Are we moving fast enough? Because just from this conversation, the stuff that I've learned that I had no idea about, it seems to me that we're way behind. I don't know if you've got an idea about that, Jess.
So we don't actually know. We don't really know what is digital life like in Scotland. But I would make two observations on that. The first one is a basic one, which is about where our communities lie. We've got quite a large rural area, and rural populations will be more reliant on technology for services and information and goods and entertainment, all kinds of stuff. So there's more reliance on tech, which might mean people are potentially more at risk online as well. I don't know. The other aspect to think about is this online-offline thing. So if you take any sort of policy area offline, there's probably going to be an online aspect to it. The little bits of research, for example, that show that child poverty is related to be more at risk online. If you've got mental health challenges, if you've got physical disability, all kinds of different vulnerabilities, you're more likely to be at risk online. I think about things like crime, right, which is basically moved online. Education, employment, all aspects of life in Scotland will have an online element. And so really, I would suggest that probably our benefits and our risks online are going to mirror what's actually happening in the offline world, if you know what I mean.
Can I ask you about gender? Because we've been kind of talking and we've mentioned girls quite a lot. Boys can be subject to online abuse. And
yeah, certainly.
We don't really talk about that much, do we?
No, I mean, we did over the last year. Of course, the National Crime Agency issued its alert about sextortion, which is primarily focused on teenage boys. So that's become a huge area of concern.
Explain a little bit about what that means.
So intimate image abuse, right, which is where somebody might share an intimate image of yours or threaten to share an intimate image of yours. And what we'll see with that is that's quite gender-based. So women tend to be threatened or have their imagery shared by men, right? But another sort of model there is the criminal model, and it's where somebody, your images are threatened to be shared unless you do something for that person. So it could be paying them money, it could be giving them more images, right? So that tends to be a criminal gang type operation, and that targets primarily teenage boys.
Is that what you, does that sort of tally with your kind of profile of what's happening in the police?
Yeah, so sextortion in terms of young boys would usually be the threat to send an image of them in exchange for money, for example. And it's very damaging and it happens a lot.
How do you approach that? Is it the same approach then when you go to talk to the parents? Is it different when it is a boy you're talking about? I'm just trying to think of the considerations you have to think about that, you know, we're all talking in terms of girls generally. Mm-hmm. What's the difference? Is it the same conversation basically?
Yeah, so I don't think it matters what if you're male or female. If someone's threatened to share an image of you online, that's so traumatic, no matter what gender you are.
Because we're talking about shame. We're talking about people being mortified by the idea that this stuff's going to get out there. And that's powerful leverage, isn't it?
Yes.
Especially for young people.
Yes, definitely. For anyone to be victim of that type of offence, whether you're an adult or a child, it's traumatic, but even more so for a child, especially when they're being told, if you don't send me £50, for example, or if you don't send me another picture, I'm going to send this to all the friends on your Facebook page, for example. It's very damaging to...
Can we talk about shame? Just
I was just briefly about to ask you, because I was just thinking about Gisèle Pelicot and the case in France, which is a completely different thing, but the fact that she refused to be shamed by what had been done to her. She is the victim of a crime, and she was taking power from the fact that she was saying, no, I'm not going to allow myself to be defined by that. Does that in any way help people that are feeling victimised, abused online, feel that this has been done to them? They have not invited this. It is not their fault. They have been led into something awful happening. They didn't initiate this.
I'm sure, absolutely, I'm sure it helps. I was chatting to somebody recently, actually, who, you know, I mentioned that I used to do the sort of childline school visits, and I stopped in the pandemic and didn't pick it up again. But I was talking to somebody recently who still does those, and she's been doing them for about 10 years. And she said to me that she reckons that when she's going into primary schools, children these days are more open to talking about, in an age-appropriate way, mm-hmm. the idea that children can be abused. She said you get less of the sort of nervous giggling So I think maybe as societally, we are starting to grapple a little bit more with some of these things and talk about them better. I wanted to pick up on the shame thing. You've reminded me, actually, of a great book by John Ronson. Great. So You've Been Publicly Shamed, which is really good.
And I think it's an amazing book.
Yeah, great book. Now, what I wanted to come back to was just to pull it full circle, I suppose, back to the education approach. So a common theme that we will hear, well, just across society is, you know, don't do that thing because it'll be online forever. Now, if you think about why is that a problem? Why is it being online a problem, you know? And the reason it's a problem is because you'll be ashamed. So we are using shame as a preventive tool, right? And then when something happens to a child, well, why didn't you tell us? You know, nothing to be ashamed for. So it's mixed messages. Yes, mixed messages, absolutely. Yeah.
So, I mean, what can we do? Just stop saying that, basically.
So my suggestion on this, when we do that kind of messaging, what we're doing is we're taking away power. We're saying you have no power and you're going to be shamed. You're going to have no control. Now, when we do that with children, that preventive messaging, it all comes from the right place. We're really trying to do our best. But the idea is that we know, for example, that children share sexual imagery with, you know, boyfriends and girlfriends. We know that happens. And the problem is if we do that preventive messaging, don't share, it'll be online forever. You know, you'll be ashamed. It'll be terrible. And there's nothing you can do about it. And then a small proportion of those young people have already done that. And now away you go to maths and my brain exploding. Oh, now I can't tell anybody about it because, I've just learned it's illegal as well. It was illegal. That image is illegal. It's going to be online forever. There's nothing I can do about it. And I have to go to maths.
Surely you have to caution young people and say, be aware of this.
So,
absolutely.
And I mean, I'm saying all of this and I'm sure that's not what's happening. Yeah, I think we've moved on a lot from that message. I don't want to give the impression that's what's happening. So I don't think it is. But absolutely, the messaging is really about harm reduction, right? There are lots of risks with this kind of behaviour. We really don't think it's a good idea. And by the way, it's illegal, right? Yes. If you've done anything like this, right, here's what you can do. It's just making sure you've got that kind of second bit in. Because what we really want to get to with young people is that they are knowledgeable and understand, recognise risk, can use that information to make informed choices if they're capable to do so, informed choices about what they do online, can get help if they need it, etc. So that's what we're looking to do, is to support young people to get to that point.
I'm just wondering how helpful or not it is to say something is illegal. I mean, is it actually something that helps people to think twice, do you believe, Kirsty? Or is this something that most young people are like, yeah, whatever, there's lots of stuff that's illegal. This is very small beer.
Oh, it's difficult to say because that might scare some children. Like you say, we don't want to make them think that they're doing something wrong if they've done that already, if they've shared an image already. We don't want to scare them into thinking, I can't tell anyone about this now because I've done this and now I'm getting told it's illegal. So it's a really hard balancing act of how to, keep them safe. And
I'm sure I came across a little bit of research, and again, I wish I could quote these things, which suggested that messaging may be helpful, particularly for boys. There is a bit of a response from boys if they know that something is illegal. But it's just about having that wider context around it as well and making sure that young people know your life isn't over if you have done something. Like there are steps you can take.
Well, we're drawing to a close now and you've answered so many questions, but I'm going to end by saying I'd like you both to give me examples of impediments, barriers, bugbears, or something positive that we should think about when we consider this whole conversation as a whole.
So Stop It Now, which you obviously mentioned earlier, is an organisation that we work with in police. So every time we deal with a perpetrator of these types of offences or even the families of the perpetrator, we direct them to Stop It Now, who can give advice and support to people who are maybe committing these types of offences online themselves or the family members who maybe live with someone who's committing these types of offences. I think it's difficult because if you think about someone who is committing these offences online and they know what they're doing is wrong, who do they go to for help or advice to stop doing that?
Do they want to stop doing it sometimes? Because I'm just wondering if there's regret or there's a lot to unpack and the motivation for why somebody is doing this in the first place. But do you feel that there is an appetite for people to seek help that are doing this?
Yes, I've dealt with people who have committed these types of offences who have openly said to me, I'm glad you've came. I'm glad you've caught me because I didn't know how to stop doing this. And we then direct them to Stop It Now. So yeah, some of them are glad to be caught, which surprised me because I didn't think that would ever be the case. And some of them have said, I've been waiting on this knock on the door for months, years.
Is that common?
It does happen more often than you would probably think.
So what's the biggest barrier to things improving, do you think? Is it, again, we're going to say that word resources. I'm going to whack myself in the head again. But is it down to resources?
I think resources is obviously one part of it. But it's so complex. It's such a complex topic that we've covered so many different things even in this conversation that how do you tie them all together to make the internet a safer place for everybody, including children? I don't think there's just a one answer. There's so much involved. It's difficult.
It's a societal thing. Jess, I'm going to ask you for the bad stuff first and then the good stuff. So what's the biggest barrier to this improving?
My suggestion, I suppose, would be to people is, what do you know about the children and young people that you serve in terms of their online lives? And then working back from that. So it's this idea that ignorance is bliss, right? So we know that, oh yeah, none of the children that I work with or serve are being bullied online or being abused online or da 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 because they haven't told you, but then you probably haven't asked them. So, you know, this is real back to basics stuff, I think, is have we spoken to children and young people? Have we built that into our sort of process and policy development? Because if we haven't asked, we probably don't really know what's going on. So that would be my kind of number one thing, I suppose, really thinking of it strategically about is there something that we could maybe do differently? And I'm sure there's good practice happening. I don't want to...
No, it's not.
There's wonderful stuff happening out there.
Yeah.
But there's definitely bits where we don't know, so we're
could
not
do better.
Yeah.
So what's the good news?
What's the good news is... You know what I'm saying? I mean, I've been doing this for about 9 or 10 years in Scotland, and it used to be quite niche, and now it's not. So I'm seeing lots of people doing this kind of work, which is great. I'm seeing parent resources coming out. I'm seeing all kinds of different workshops and things that are being hosted. And I'm just seeing more of an interest in it, I suppose, I would say. So I think that's fantastic. I think there's always more to go, but definitely I think there's much more awareness now than there used to be.
Oof, we're going to end on an up. Amazing. Listen, thank you so much. What a slaloming, wide-ranging conversation I threw at you. And thank you very much for being such wonderful experts and talking to us. I hope we've learned a lot from this. I certainly have. I'm going to go away and completely rethink everything I thought was the case. But anyway, to Jess, to Kirsty, thank you so much for your time.
Thank you.
You.